Okay, let's go ahead and open up to Romans 7. We're going to head over there. We're still doing a little transition work here. I thought we'd start by just doing a little summary. You can go to the first slide, first summary, and we can kind of just introduce tonight by bringing out the point that Romans 5 and 6 solves the plight of the old humanity under Adam and sin, especially for the Gentiles. And that's viewing it kind of from the standpoint of Israel, from the standpoint of the Jews. That's what we've been talking about for the last week or two. Well, not last week because it was Thanksgiving, but the week or two before that. And that's what we're trying to draw out there, is that Romans 5, 6 answers our most basic problem. It solves the issues that are true of fallen humanity brought up in the last half of Romans 1. And I just listed a few here. We're not going to turn to Romans 1. We've discussed this in the past, but I thought it would be a good idea to just draw this out again, because then when we get to Romans 7, he's going to do an interesting thing. Having dealt with a plight of fallen humanity at the end of Romans 1, in Romans 7, he's going to solve the problem that he brings up in Romans 2. And that's what we're really going to look at tonight. But first, let's just remind ourselves that in that last half of Romans 1, the plight of fallen humanity, separated from God in unbelief, descending into the pit of dying, decaying, corruptible creation, handed over to the selfish lusts of their own foolish, darkened hearts and reprobate minds under the power of sin and death. And they followed the satanic lie of independence. They thought, fallen humanity thought, in declaring their independence from God, that they actually became independent. That's the big lie of Satan. Mankind wasn't created to be independent. They're created to be dependent beings. And of course, they're created to be dependent on God. And the big lie of Satan is that they could be their own gods. They could be their own little independent, autonomous, small g gods, the rulers of their own little universes. But Paul rips that wide open. God and Paul ripped that wide open and say, no, when they declared in the rebellion against God, when they declared their independence from God, they didn't become independent. That was just, they proclaimed that. I thought they were wise in doing that, but it just showed they were fools, because in declaring their independence, they didn't become independent. They were just handed over to another master, master sin and master death. So they're enslaved to sin that leads to death. And the one thing they were free of is righteousness. And their bodily existence in that last half of Romans 1 was permeated with sin and death. Sin destroyed, ruined our relationship with God. It ruined our relationship with fellow humans, our bodily existence with each other. And it ruined our relationship even with ourselves. And it brought the whole of fallen humanity down into an existence that was then non-fruit-bearing, absolutely barren, couldn't do anything that pleases God, barren and fruitless. And then when you go to chapter 6, you see that every one of those points is counteracted. By the time you get to Romans 5 and 6, that's all dealt with. We're reconciled to God in Romans 5, verse 1, having been justified by faith. We now have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Romans 6 tells us that where we were descending into the pit of corruptible, dying creation, God raised us up together with Christ, seated us. We could throw Ephesians in here, seated us together with Christ in the heavenlies, taking us to the highest of heights. In Romans 1, we were handed over to sin and death, another master, master sin and master death. In Romans 6, 17, we're handed over to Pauline grace that recreates the heart by focusing, and that Pauline grace focuses our attention on Christ crucified and him risen from the grave, that crucified Christ, the agape love displayed there, that the Holy Spirit takes, overflows our heart with, recreates the heart with that agape love of God at the cross of Christ, and that is what motivates us. Well, for it recreates our heart, it solves the heart issue, and then it motivates us to present the parts of our bodies to God for His service, and allows Him to work in and through us based on now a selfless service to Him rather than selfish interest that we had back in Romans 1. In doing that, He freed us from master sin and enslaved us to righteousness and life. And now we can, for the first time since Romans 1, we can now participate in a bodily existence that's permeated not with sin and death, but permeated with righteousness and life. Not an existence that's non-fruit-bearing and barren, but an existence that bears much fruit unto God. What a change. I hope a chart like this really drives home how wonderful grace is and its working and what all that God accomplished for us on that cross when He went there. It's changed everything. It's the antidote, the solution to everything that was wrong with us. And by the time you get to chapter 5 and 6, everything in that first or last half of Romans 1 is taken care of. It's dealt. There's an antidote. It's the solution has been given. But now as we go into Romans 7, what I'd suggest now what he's going to do, if Romans 5 and 6 solves the plight of the old humanity under Adam, and sin, especially with regard to the Gentiles, you know, that's how the Jews looked at the Gentiles. They looked at the Gentiles as the sinners. Just like we read in our Matthew account, they look at the, the really low life, the publican and those involved in egregious sins, like a sexual immorality and things like that, as the sinners. The Pharisees didn't consider themselves sinners. They were sinners. And even Paul, when he's talking to Peter in Galatians, he talks about the Jews viewing the Gentiles as the sinners. The Jews aren't sinners. It's the Gentiles that are sinners. And so now he's going to address in Romans 7 with a special emphasis on the Jews, on Israel, on the Jews, especially with regard to that law. So in that Romans 5 and 6, he addresses the first half of the last half of Romans 1, solving the problem of old humanity under Adam, enslaved to sin, with an emphasis on what's true of the Gentiles from a Jewish perspective. But now he's not going to let the Jews off the hook in Romans 7. Now he's going to go into Romans 2, and he's going to show them, solve for them the plight of the old humanity under Adam and the law. And that's going to have a special reference to the Jews. They were the only ones who were placed under that Mosaic law. They were the only ones. So now let's go ahead. We haven't spent much time in Romans 2. It'd be a good idea to get that back in our thought processes. We spent quite a bit of time in Romans 1 and while we were in Romans 6. Now that we're in Romans 7, let's go back to Romans 2 and just look at a couple things. Remember, when you get to chapter 2, Paul is now addressing someone who doesn't like what he said in Romans 1. They don't want to view themselves as sinners, enslaved to sin, where everything they do is permeated with death and their hearts are evil and foolish and darkened. So he's going to now talk about those people, and he's going to start out with all people, and then he's going to emphasize and draw attention to the Jews in particular about those who think now they can put cover up that sinful nature, improve that sinful nature, make that sinful nature presentable to God, put a veneer over that sinful nature that will make them acceptable to God, give them a way to do something that is good. And this could be, he starts out with verse 1, chapter 2, verse 1, "Therefore thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever you are. For wherein thou judgest another, you condemn yourself. For you that judges do the same thing. But we are sure the judgment of God is according to truth against them which commit such things." Those who can, now they're trying to cover up all the sinfulness he brought up at the end of chapter one and try to place a veneer of righteousness, of human righteousness that would be acceptable to God. And this could be, he's going to emphasize this with the Jews and the Mosaic law in a few verses down. But this, he's emphasizing everybody, even the Gentiles. They had their groups of moralists and their philosophers and those who tried to follow the virtues. And they felt if they did that, they would be good. They'd be better than others. So good enough for God. And he brings out the point here that that's absolutely not the case. No matter what kind of a law you put a sinner under, it always is going to bring condemnation and wrath and judgment. It never brings righteousness and no condemnation. So that in chapter two, he drives home the plight of fallen humanity under any kind of law, and especially with regard to that Mosaic law. And you stand condemned. Putting a veneer over that sinful nature isn't going to cover up the fact that the heart has a problem. It's a heart problem. And I just want you to notice how he goes in the heart problem here. In Romans 1, the heart problem was that it was foolish and darkened. Now watch what happens when someone rejects the grace of God and tries to establish their own righteousness by putting on a veneer of morality or virtues or some kind of human righteousness of their own. Look at verse 5. But after thy hardness and impenitent heart, now we've gone from chapter 1 where it was foolish and darkened heart. Now we have the impenitent and hardened heart. They're rejecting more and more the grace of God. What they should have done is fall on the grace of God. Instead, they're trying to cover up that sinful nature with a veneer, with moralism, with virtues, with all those things by making their own laws and then meeting them and then thinking they're better than others and therefore good enough for God. But the law always condemns. Look at verse 5, the end of verse 5 here. But after thy hardness and impenitent heart treasureth up unto thyself wrath against the day of wrath and the revelation of the righteous judgment of God. This always results going into any kind of a law system, whether it be a Gentile law system or it be the Mosaic law system, the perfect and holy and divinely originated law of Moses. Let's look down and just see how he brings this out here. He's going to tie in now this moralist law system and a Gentile law system and the Mosaic law system. Go down to verse 12. Verse 12, for as many as have sinned without law shall also perish without law. And as many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law. So no matter how you come out, if you enter a law system of any kind with God, you always come out the door of condemnation, judgment, perishing, and destruction. Now watch how this develops. Verse 12, he's going to finish up with the Gentiles here, and then he's going to go on to the Jews. Verse 13. For the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified before God. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, that's the Mosaic law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves. Kind of convoluted, but what he's basically saying there is that the very fact Gentiles have law systems, of course, the United States has a law system. Every Gentile nation has a law system, which proves the very point Paul's making here that every Gentile nation is based on a fallen humanity that requires a law. To identify sin, turn it into transgression and a sign of punishment. And he says that they go under this law. They may not have the Mosaic law, but they do have, as a creation of God, a general compass that gives them basic. It's not perfect. It's not always running perfectly, but it gives them an idea between right and wrong. And when that goes into effect, that becomes a law unto itself. look what he says here in verse 14. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, the Mosaic law, do by nature the things contained in the law, the Gentiles knew, even without the Mosaic law, they knew it was wrong to steal. They knew it was wrong to lie and bear false witness and not and to commit adultery. They knew all that. But when they came up with their own laws based on that, it becomes a law unto itself. And now, look what he says in verse 14. He says, when that becomes a law unto itself, that verse 15, which show the work of the law written in their hearts. What's the work of the law written in their hearts? See, he's going to describe a chain of events here. The Gentiles know that something is right or wrong. And in that moment, they realize that that becomes a law unto itself. And then that law begins to work in their hearts. And what's the work of the law? Just keep your finger here, but flip over two pages or a couple pages, however many is in your Bible, and go to Romans 4, verse 15. Just a couple pages over, Romans 4, verse 15. This is the work of the law. Because the law worketh wrath. That's the work of the law. With these Gentiles, they recognize a basic right or wrong that becomes a law in itself. It begins to work in the heart. And when the law goes to work, it's not to produce righteousness. It's not to show what they're doing right. It's to show what they're doing wrong and to assign wrath to it, judgment, condemnation. And then what happens? Verse 14. Verse 15, wherefore they show the work of the law. The law goes to work in their hearts and brings condemnation and wrath. Their conscience then kicks into gear and it bears witness. Their conscience recognizes, has that basic recognition, and it supports that law working in the heart. And then what happens? Verse 15, and bearing the conscience bear witness to the truth of the wrath they deserve from the law, and their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another. And then that kicks in the mind, and the mind is going to come up with either excuses to escape the wrath of God, or it's going to come up with accuses and acknowledge that it deserves the wrath of God. Either door you come out of, for this Gentile chain of events, either door you come out of, you still end up in Romans 2, verse 16. You end up in the day of wrath. Look at verse 16. In the day when God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ, according to my gospel. No matter how you look at it, that any time you try and approach God on a law basis, all you end up is with wrath and judgment at the judgment of God. And now he's going to draw that out, that whole concept, and he's going to apply it now directly to the Jews. So the law in chapter 2 can only bring condemnation. The law in chapter 2 can only put on display an impenitent and unrepentant and hardened heart. And the law show that all perish. With or without the law, you're going to perish based on any kind of a law system. There's chapter 2 shows that the law it doesn't alleviate sin or control sin. The law simply exposes sin, magnifies sin, multiplies sin, gives an existence on the externals that are non-fruit bearing. And now he's going to show bring the Jew into this and show that it's the same thing for Israel under that law. Look at verse 17. Verse 17, behold, thou art called a Jew, and they rest in the law. See, that's the wrong point, beginning point right there. What does Hebrews talk all about? There is, under the Mosaic law, there was never any time for rest. All it was, you finish one sacrifice, it's time to start the next sacrifice. You do one thing, it's time to start the next thing. They never sat down. They never closed up. They never turned the lights off. It's just one thing after another. And here he's talking about the Jews rested in the law. Well, that was a big mistake right at the beginning. There is no rest in that Mosaic law. And they make their boast of God and know his will and approve the things that are more excellent, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that thou thyself art a guide of the blind, a light of them which are in darkness. See, they thought all these things were true of them because they had the law. They thought this, all these things were true of them just because God gave them the law. They had a privileged status before God that automatically removed them from condemnation and wrath. But Paul's going to drive this home, and he's going to, especially when we get over to Romans 7, he's going to answer this situation of the plight of the people under law, especially the Jews, and he's going to explain that that's not the case. That's not the case. They, under the law, all the law can do is bring sin and death, condemnation and punishment. The law kills. The law kills. And we're going to see that when we get over to Romans 7. But I just want to bring out here why he's now going to this chapter 2 of Romans. Look what he says in verse 20. And the instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, which has the form of knowledge and of the truth in the law. Thou, therefore, which teaches another, teaches thou not thyself? See, now they thought that having the law gave them a privileged position that allowed them to escape God's wrath. They thought just teaching the law allowed them to escape God's wrath. But God and Paul say, no, it's doing the law. And now he's going to show them that the problem wasn't that they had or didn't have or taught or didn't taught. It was that they didn't do the law. And see, that's what the law is brought out to do. It's not to show you how righteous you are. It's to show you how unrighteous you are. Verse 21, thou therefore which teaches another, teaches thou not thyself? Thou that preachest a man should not steal, do you steal? Thou that sayest a man should not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? Thou that abhorrest idols, do you not commit a sacrilege? And that adultery and sacrilege, he puts that together. I think that indicates he's talking more than about just the adultery of sexual immorality. He's talking about the adultery that typified the nation of Israel as an adulterous wife. Jehovah, the adulterous nation that had gone to idolatry from devotedness to Jehovah. Thou makest, verse 23, thou makest thy boast in the law. Though breaking the law, you dishonored God. See, they claim just having the law, they honored God, but they broke the law and that dishonored God. Verse 24, we'll just read one more verse here. Verse 24, for the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles through you, as it is written. That law that they were under didn't bring them into blessings and righteousness. It brought them into unrighteousness and the curses of the law that through their breaking of it dishonored God and falling under the curses of that law, blasphemed God's name among the Gentiles. That's what happened with Israel 1,500 years under that law. And let's just see what the actual problem was. Let's go down to verse 28. For he is not a Jew, which is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision, which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew, which is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart and the spirit, and not of the letter, whose praise is of God, is not of men, but of God. And now, when just keeping some of those things in mind, we're going to see a correlation between Romans 7 and maybe the first four verses of Romans 8 and the false understanding of the law that Paul and God reveal and expose in Romans 2. The law can only bring condemnation. In Romans 8:1, we see the solution to that of no condemnation. And it doesn't come from a law system. It comes from a grace system. in the old humanity of under Adam, under that law. It addressed, brought about that hardened and unrepentant heart. And for the Jew, he talks about in verse 29 there, the uncircumcised heart. It was a heart issue. The law couldn't address the heart issue. That's what's so important about Romans 5 to 8. It addresses the heart issue, the one thing man couldn't address on his own, and even the law couldn't correct. It was only by grace that that can be corrected. They had fallen for the lie of Satan that the law controls and alleviates sins. He's going to explain in Romans of 7 and 8 that the law doesn't alleviate and control sin. The law multiplies and incites sin and exposes enslavement to sin. Let's just go and look at a couple of these things. I would go on the way back to Romans 7, stop at Romans 3. Romans 3, verse 20. Romans 3, I guess we begin at verse 19. Now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law. That would be the Jews. Now, this is going to be a very important thing when we understand why God even allowed Israel and her rebellion to enter into that law. Here he explains it. Now we know that the things were written, that things whatsoever were written in the law, it saith to them under the law, that's Israel, who entered that law in her rebellion. We've looked at that before over in Exodus 19. That every mouth may be stopped and the whole world may be guilty before God. See, what God's doing is he's taking that nation of Israel, and during that trip from Goshen in Egypt all the way to Sinai, he was trying to teach them if they're going to be the people he created them to be, it would have to be based on a grace system. It have to be based on the grace resident in his Jehovah name. All he wanted them to do was to hold up the rod of God of faith and watch the salvation of the Lord kick into action. That's all he had to do. He gave them that Jehovah name. I will be your sustenance. I will be your provider. I will be your conquering hero. I will be your righteousness. I will be everything you need me to be. And when you get just before Sinai, how does he sum up the trip from Goshen to Sinai? He says that I carried you along as on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. And then he gives them that final exam. So now, are you going to continue on based on my Jehovah grace and just holding up the rod of God of faith? Or are you going to try and do it on your own? And what is the big mistake of the Israel? They said, we will do it on our own at Sinai. And what immediately happened? A couple verses before that, he explains he carried them along as on eagle's wings and brought them to himself. They say, we will do it ourselves. Reject God doing it. We will do it ourselves. And God allows them to enter into, out of their rebellion, enter into that law contract. And what immediately happens? Thunder, earthquake, lightning, rumbling, smoke. And he says, Moses, get down that hill and get those people away from me, lest they be put to death. That's a law system. That's what the law does. And God allowed, we're going to look at this a little more later, God allowed the nation of Israel in her rebellion to enter into that law covenant. For this purpose, Paul explains in Romans 3:19, for the purpose, he's going to now run an experiment, put on display something, maybe with our COVID situation and the whole vaccination thing, maybe we can kind of get an example of it from that. What do when they want to test a vaccine? They get 50 or 100,000 people, they give them the vaccine, and they see what happens. But that's kind of like what God's doing. And in that vaccination, what happens to those 100,000 people? If it passes, if it works on everybody, then they go out and the assumption is it's going to work on the rest of humanity that way as well. Same type of thing that God's doing with the nation of Israel. He takes one small group of fallen humanity, the nation of Israel, and in her rebellion allows them to enter into that law contract, and in for the purpose of running an experiment, for the purpose of proving something about fallen humanity. And he's proving something through the fallen humanity of the nation of Israel, that if Israel can't produce righteousness based on the law, no one else can. God took the nation Israel, put them in the best circumstances possible. He took care of them. He gave them advantages. He gave them benefits. He gave them privileges. He gave them his word. He gave them his presence. He gave them his leadership. He gave them Christ. He gave them the contracts, the promises, the covenant, I should say, the promises. He's given them all that. And what God is showing with the nation of Israel is that even Israel, with all those privileges, all those benefits, all the divine interaction, all that, and God still, excuse me, and they still couldn't produce righteousness acceptable to God. They fell 1,500 years, for the most part, under the curses of the law. And if that's true of the nation of Israel, with all her privileges, all her benefits, all her blessings, all her advantages, he's proving, he's silencing the whole humanity, Paul says here in Romans 3:19, because if even Israel couldn't produce its own righteousness based on the law, with all its divine advantages, no one else with far less, no other Gentile nation with far less, going to be able to do it either. He's ran an experiment. It's now gone from theory to fact. It's written in the book. He's not running the experiment again. There's no more opportunity. People can't go back. God's not allowing people to even enter into a law relationship with him. It's over. It's proven. He proved it 1,500 years with the nation of Israel. End of story. That's not even an option anymore. And he's going to now, he's proven to the world that you can't relate to him or produce righteousness on the basis of the law. They needed something else. There has to be another way. And that's what we're going to see as we go into here now in Romans 7, kind of set up that whole Romans 7. All right, so let's go ahead and go over to Romans 7. Romans 7. And it's important to see now that he's going to be bringing out a very important question at this point. Here's the question. This is the million-dollar question of Christianity. This is the million-dollar question everybody should be asking by the time they get to Romans 5, Romans 6, and Romans 7. In Romans 5 and 6, we saw now for the first time we could present ourselves to God. We can be under the right motivation, selflessly, based on the love of God at the cross of Christ, motivated by that selfless love, so that God can work in and through us to be dispensers of his grace and peace to a lost humanity, participants in his glory, bearing fruit unto God. That's all from that last few verses of Romans 6. Now, let's just see an example of this. Let's go to Romans 1. I know I made you go back to Romans 7, but let's go back to Romans 1. Let me just read one more verse to you here. The question I want you to think about is, how did this happen? How did we go from Romans 1 and 2, the complete fall and ruin of humanity, that couldn't do anything that pleases God, that couldn't produce any righteousness on its own, and get into chapters 5, 6, 7, and 8, where now we're participants in his glory. He's working in and through us unto righteousness and life. Look what we see in an example here with the Romans themselves. Remember, the Romans were primarily a Gentile group. most of them came out of idolatry, paganism, superstition, the whole pagan religious system. And look what he says about them in Romans 1, verse 8. Romans 1, verse 8. First, I thank my God. This is Paul thanking God through Jesus Christ for you all, the Romans, the Roman believers, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. Now, isn't that interesting? The Romans had responded in faith, and their faith was spoken of throughout the whole world. You know what another way of saying that is? They were bearing fruit under righteousness. They were bearing fruit. And here's the million-dollar question. That's how did God get this this group, for the most part, idolatrous, Gentile, pagan believers who heard Pauline grace, who are handed over to Pauline grace, they heard the message, they believed it, their faith was counted for righteousness, and now they're bearing much fruit. It says their faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. They're displayers of God's glory. They're displayers of God's truth. They're participants in what he's doing today. And how long did these Romans have this information? Maybe months, maybe years. Of course, we know Paul didn't visit them directly as of yet, but he had a large contingent of co-workers who were at work in Rome, no doubt going back and forth, bringing his preaching to them. And there was also many books, Pauline epistles, already in circulation that I'm sure they had access to and could read. And they, just based on that faith, they were now participants in God's glory. And here's the question. How did these idolatrous, pagan, Gentile sinners, an enemy status before God, in a matter of months or years, become displayers of God's glory throughout the whole world, when even Israel, 1,500 years under the law, all they could do was blaspheme God's name among the Gentiles? That's the question. How could God achieve all this through these Gentile, idol-worshipping Gentiles, that even in 1,500 years, he couldn't accomplish through the nation of Israel? What is it that made these Gentile Romans, for the most part, participants in God's glory, displayers of his glory? Did he hand them over to the Mosaic law? Or God do that by handing them over to Pauline grace? And of course, that's the key thing here. That's what caused the change in outcomes. That's what 1,500 years Israel was under the law. And go back to chapter 2, because I don't want you to take my word for this. I want to just see what Paul writes here. Look at verse 23, chapter 2, verse 23. Thou that makest thy boast in the law through breaking the law dishonors God. They didn't do the law. They broke the law. That brought dishonor to God. That brought them in the curses of the law. And look at verse 24. For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles through you. And that brought them, that led to their blaspheming God's name among the Gentiles. 1,500 years under the law, and that's where it got them. Then you have this group of Gentile, idol-worshipping, pagan sinners who receive Paul's gospel of grace, and in months, maybe years, they are already displaying and participating the glory of God throughout the whole world. How did God accomplish that? This is really so important. Paul's going to bring this up in Galatians, to the Galatians as well. He didn't accomplish it by handing them over to the Mosaic law or any law. Religious systems say that, man-made theological systems say that, but that's not the way they did it. They became proclaimers and displayers and participants in God's glory throughout the whole world because they were handed over to Pauline grace. And then God was able to do that. with and in and through them. What he couldn't do for 1,500 years with Israel under the law, he could do with these Gentile sinners and on enemy status before him and as displayers of his glory. Didn't do it by handing them over to a law system. He did it by handing them over to a grace system. And so now as we go from Romans 6 to 7, we can start heading back that way, Romans 6 and 7. Well, Paul wants to make sure the Romans fully understand that God was producing much fruit. That's actually a typo there. It should say much fruit, not by the law, but by grace. So insert the word not there. Not by the law, but by grace. It wasn't because of who they were and what they did, but who Christ is and what he did, who God is and what he's done. The former calls would be a law system. The law called on Israel's flesh to produce works acceptable to God. But we'll do it ourselves. And we see what happened over those 1,500 years. We've just been talking about that. But the Pauline grace system, or any grace system, but of course we are under the Pauline grace system, that is God working in and through us. That's a grace, faith, spirit system. And that is always successful. That's always victorious because it's God doing the work, God working in and through us. Let's look at an example here. Keep your finger in chapter 7. Let's just go over to Galatians 3 and read how astounded Paul is when the Galatians are thinking enough about the question. Remember, the Galatians were a bunch of idol-worshipping sinner Gentiles, pagans, enemy status before God, sinners. And God was performing a great work among them. And look what Paul says. He says, "Oh, foolish Galatians." This is Galatians 3, verse 1. "Oh, foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you that you should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ hath been evidently set forth, crucified among you?" And that's why we made a big deal out of this verse, with whole crucified Christ and the love of God displayed there. "This only," verse 2, "what I learn of you, received ye the Spirit by the works of the law or by the hearing of faith? Are you so foolish? Having begun in the Spirit, are you now made perfect by the flesh?" They'd received all these blessings, all this was occurring in and through their assembly through the work of God the Holy Spirit. And now someone was coming along and telling them they needed to complete it, they needed to add to it, a law system. They needed to add their own flesh works in there. And Paul just comes in and demolishes that whole idea. How did the Romans, how did the Galatians, how did the Colossians, how did the Ephesians, how did they all, for the most part, Gentile sinners, idol-worshiping, the Thessalonians, how did they become glorifiers of God? By being handed over to a law system? No, it was by being handed over to a grace system, the Pauline grace system. All that's what caused that. And in Romans 7, he's going to really demolish this whole concept, especially with regard to the Jews and the law and the role of the law in the Christian's life, the believer's life. God had turned various pagan idol worshippers into a group of fruit-bearing believers. He didn't do this by handing them over to the Mosaic law, but by handing them over to grace. But now this leads us back to Romans 7. So let's go back to Romans 7. Romans 7, and let's tie together these two verses. Go to just a couple of verses ahead. I know I keep saying Romans 7, then we go someplace else, but just scan to the end of chapter 6, verse 14. Chapter 6, verse 14. And what does he think? He breaks into this argument. We spent a lot of time on this verse earlier. "For sin shall not have dominion over you." Now, just think about that for a second. He's saying we already know we've been freed from sin. The ball and chain has been cut. And he says you'll remain in that freedom state. You're free no matter what from sin. Sin can never, ever have dominion over you. The doors of the cell have been opened and they've been locked open. You're free to go. But of course, the flesh can go back to sin, can go back to voluntarily serving sin. He's not enslaved. He's not forced to be under sin like he was in the old humanity, but he can, through wrong doctrine mostly, serve sin again. And he's saying here is that the way you're positionally freed from sin and the way you, in your practice, you remain free from sin. Now, religion tells you what? Religion tells you the exact opposite of what Paul says here. They say if you don't want sin to have dominion over someone, you have to put them under a law system. And you get that in all kinds, whether it be Catholicism, Baptist, where, you know, don't wear a lipstick, don't do this, don't go to movies, don't, all that kind, all these little, that's how you get them to not have sin dominion over you. But Paul says the exact opposite. By going back to a law system, or to a law system, of course, the Gentiles were never under a law system. Going to a law system is the way you allow sin to have dominion over you. And that's going to be one of his big discussion points in Romans 7. But here in Romans 14, it says sin doesn't have dominion over you as long as you stay in a grace system. And then he picks that up in chapter 7, verse 1. And he's going to talk about this now. Know ye not, brethren, for I speak to them that know the law. Now, a lot of people come in here and they change the meaning of law to more general term. Law is a principle. Law is a general thing. I really don't think that's what he's talking about here. Throughout the whole passage, it's referring to Mosaic law. And the end of chapter 6 there, it was certainly the Mosaic law. So I think he's now zeroing in on the Jew in that Mosaic law and showing now what the real relationship, breaking the lie that the law controls and regulates and alleviates sin, and shows what the law really does, especially for those under that Mosaic law. And so I think he's going to bring that out here. And the important thing that he's going to drive home is he wants them to think about this. He's going to, because they're going to have a tendency to think that while Pauline grace, Queen grace, may be okay for the Gentiles, free them from sin, for the Jews, though, they should continue with the law. So that's what they're going to very possibly come to the conclusion. Where does this leave? Now, by the time you get to the end of chapter 6, you've been freed from sin, and and you're freed from the dominion of death. You've been freed from all that. You've been made participants in God's glory. You've been you're now fruit bearing. And the Jew, while a minority in the Roman assembly, was obviously a very strong minority. We know that just from the first four chapters. I think we said when we were going through those that almost there's a reference to the Old Testament scriptures, the Jewish Old Testament scriptures, for every verse that's in the first four chapters. So he's writing in those first four chapters to the Jews, especially that Jewish element, that strong Jewish element within the Roman assembly. And they might have come to the conclusion that while the Queen grace may be good enough for the Gentiles, they need the law as well. And that's what he's going to start to delineate and kind of expand on in Romans 7. Did Pauline grace also hold sway over the Jews, proselytes, and God-fearers, those associated in some way with Judaism? Jews themselves, of course, would all fall under this. Proselytes would be Gentiles who actually convert to Judaism and come under that law. And you can have Gentiles who are God-fearers, who just associate, come to God through the Jews, but don't actually convert to Judaism, but still come under that law, did they need to continue under that law? That's the thing he's going to drive home there. He's going to really drive home this point for the Jewish believer and make sure they realize not only are they set free from sin through the death and resurrection of Christ in accord with Pauline grace, they're also set free from the law according to Pauline grace so they can bear fruit unto God. They would likely think the opposite, but Paul has to drive this point home. Paul explained in Romans 6 that as sinners, they have died to sin to produce fruit to God. In Romans 7, he's going to explain the more surprising truth that those who had been under the law would also have to die to the law to produce fruit. That would be a very hard thing for a Jew to swallow. He's no doubt been under the preconceived notion that he's been bearing fruit under the law. Paul comes along and just throws all that away. No, they haven't been bearing fruit under the law. Just look at the state of the nation. They just rejected their king and Messiah. They're in ruin. The being under the law didn't bring them to the point of fulfilling God's program for Israel. That all has to come through the death and resurrection of Christ. That's what would lead to freedom from sin to bear fruit to God. And that's what would lead to freedom from the law to bear fruit unto God. And that's what he's going to bring out here now in this section. Look what he says here. Look at some of the bold statement he says. Let's go down to verse 4 of chapter 7. Wherefore, my brethren, ye also are become dead. You died to the law by the body of Christ, through the Christ and the death of Christ on the cross, that you should be married to another, even to him who is raised from the dead, that we should bring forth fruit to God. That's how they were to bring forth fruit to God. They had to die not only to sin, they had to die to the law as ones being under the law. And he's going to explain there that the law doesn't alleviate or control sin. Let's read the one more verse, and then we'll start wrapping up. Verse 5, for when we were in the flesh, the motions of sin, which were by the law, did work in our members to bring forth fruit unto death. But now delivered from the law, they had to die to the law. They had to be delivered from the law. We can now serve in a newness of spirit. There's that heart issue. That solves the heart issue, the agape love at the cross of Christ, recreating the sinner's heart to be able to serve God and God work in and through him, and not in the oldness of the letter. And that's what he's going to now drive home in chapter 7. He's going to demonstrate that the Jews needed to realize not only did especially the Gentiles need to die to sin, but the Jews needed to die to the law in order to bear fruit unto God. And this would no doubt lead them. Their natural tendency would be to think that it's Pauline grace and the law. But Paul wants to make sure they understand that, no, it's not Pauline grace and the law. It's Pauline grace without the law. It's Pauline grace or law. You can't intermix them. You can't mix them together. There is either one or the other. It's either God doing everything in and through you based on grace and faith, or it's you trying to do everything on your own through the flesh and works. Grace way is always going to work. Flesh way is always going to fail. And that's what Israel demonstrated over 1,500 years under the history of that law. They proved once and for all that sinners cannot produce fruit on law ground. And I'll just close with this. I remember hearing a story, I think it was J. Vernon McGee, who gave the story about growing pineapples in Canada. You know, we don't even have to think about it. We all know you can't grow pineapples in Canada. You can take 100 million pineapples. Now, I remember when I was a kid, we used to cut the top off a pineapple, put it in dirt, and sure enough, you'd get pineapple would sprout from that in the house. Usually didn't live very long, but you could get it to do that. But you could take 100 million pineapples up to Canada, plant them in a farm field, and you can take care of them. You can water them. You can hoe around them. You can wash their leaves. You can feed them. You can fertilize them. You can take care of them. You can, and by you come back a year later, there's not going to be any pineapples there. You can't grow pineapples in Canada. And he used that, J. Vernon McGee, I think it was, who came with that illustration. He said, that's what God was doing with the nation of Israel. He took a small group of fallen humanity, and he hoed it, he fertilized it, he gave it a bunch of benefits and advantages, and he took care of it, and he watched it, and he tried to lead it along, and he tried to get it. And 1,500 years later, there was no fruit. And the conclusion is, just like you can't grow pineapples in Canada, you can't grow righteousness in the land of fallen humanity. It's impossible. It has to be a grace, faith, spirit system, or it's going to fail. And 1,500 years of Israel under that law proves it. With that in mind, now as we go into Romans 7, I think that will open up a lot of the things he brings out in this passage.